Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
This is the last day you'll hear Jackson Hole and Federal Reserve in the same sentence for a good long while, so we will tell you what Janet Yellen said in her big speech today. Because from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 22nd of August. Great, as always, to have you with us. It is, I suppose, our version of Kremlinology. This habit business journalists have of poring over speeches by Janet Yellen as if they held the keys to the very kingdom. Be that as it may, it is still where we're going to start on this Friday. Here for our weekly wrap are Catherine Rempel from The Washington Post and John Carney from The Wall Street Journal. Hello to you both.
Hey, Kai.
Hi.
All right, John, I guess you get to go first. Janet Yellen gives a big speech. She basically says, this figuring out the economy stuff is hard. Is that a gist, a fair gist?
Yes. She basically talked about how much uncertainty there is, how things aren't going according to the Fed, the way the Fed thought it would. And so the policy might not be what people think it was going
to good. Be. I feel much better. Catherine, is that your read of this speech as well?
Yeah, she said there was a lot of uncertainty. I mean, she didn't really make any clear statements one way or the other about when we should expect rate hikes and various other big news. But that's kind of her job, is to not make news.
Right. I think the clearest
think about that for a minute, right?
The clearest statement she made was sort of don't have very firm expectations about when things are going to when rates might go up, because we don't really know.
Wait, but did anything she said change the basic expectation, which is, as of course we know, the whole ballgame when it comes to the Fed, of sometime around the middle of next year, 2015? Catherine?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I mean, I got a bunch of analyst notes from different economists at various banks and other outfits. Some said, you know, this was much more hawkish than people were expecting, meaning that, you know, rate hikes would come sooner.
No.
Some said, oh, this was way more dovish, meaning that they're going to, you know, let rates be zero in perpetuity. So I think people are kind of apt to read into it what they will.
Mm-hmm.
And I take that, you know, I take that as evidence that she didn't make a clear statement one way or the other about this.
One last thing, John, before we move on. Interesting that there were demonstrators at this speech today out in Jackson Hole, and she basically stopped and engaged, and she said, you know what, we're doing the best we can.
I thought that was very interesting. I don't think that's ever happened before, even at the height of, you know, whether it was the financial crisis or Occupy Wall Street. We didn't have protesters out in Jackson.
Yeah, protesting the Fed, right? You're like, what? okay, moving on. Bank of America, Catherine, pays $17 billion to settle charges stemming from its mortgage business in the financial crisis. So now we've had J.P. Morgan pay. We've had Citigroup pay, Bank of America. Can we now be done with the big banks and making good on the financial crisis and move on, or is there more to come?
I'm sure the banks hope so. I mean, for Bank of America, this was not their first settlement. This was like their 17th or something, or their 20th settlement. You know, they've gone through many, many rounds with different states, with different lawsuits, lots of different things. So, you know, if you look at the reaction to the settlement, this latest one, which dragged on for a while, it seems like investors believe that this will be the last for Bank of America. But, you know, there could be still things down the pipeline.
Yeah.
You know, we haven't seen any criminal prosecutions of any high-level bankers. And there's still some agitation for that. I'm not really holding my breath for that to happen. But, you know, there could be more news down the line.
Well, John, Catherine's breath notwithstanding, do these settlements mean anything until somebody actually goes on trial?
I believe that they are going to try to go after some of the people, particularly executives at Countrywide.
Countrywide. Angelo Mozzillo was in the news this week, the guy who ran Countrywide.
I think that the Justice Department, now that they've gotten the institutions out of the way, would like to go after some of these people. It will become they got the billions and billions of settlements. We actually did a little math that told us that Bank of America has now paid more in legal settlements and to repurchase bad mortgages than all of the profits they earned during the housing boom.
Wow.
From 2004 to 2007, it's actually the number, the legal settlement and repurchases is 106% of their profits.
That's
from
crazy.
2004 to 2007. Yeah. So it turned out this was a terrible, terrible thing for the banks.
That's right.
Also.
That's right.
They lost money because of it. But I do think that the Justice Department would like to have a couple sort of heads to put on
pikes.
And now that they have these statements of facts that were part of the things that Bank of America agreed to. They basically have Bank of America testifying on their behalf that Countrywide did a bunch of bad things. So
all right.
That'll
well,
help.
Yeah, we got to leave it there. John Carney from The Wall Street Journal and Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post. Thanks, you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Guy.
Thank you.
All right, we'll see you soon. Wall Street today was a little wishy-washy, truth be told. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As this economy changes, so too do its constituent parts. Case in point, higher education. The California legislature has passed a bill that will let a handful of community colleges offer four-year bachelor's degrees. Assuming Governor Jerry Brown signs the thing, California would be the 22nd state to make that change, just the latest evolution of the traditional ivory towers of academia. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
Want a philosophy degree at community college prices? Maybe a little Kant and Heidegger on the cheap? Sorry.
We're not going to see our bachelor's programs in English, math, history, sociology, chemistry, and all of those fields that are traditional liberal arts fields.
Constance Carroll is the chancellor of the San Diego Community College District.
What we will see are baccalaureate programs in workforce fields where there is high demand.
Fields like dental hygiene, information technology, automotive technology management. And it's the same deal at community colleges around the country.
They are degrees that are intended to help put people to work.
Deborah L. Floyd is a professor of higher education at Florida Atlantic University. In many cases, she says, these are fields that didn't require a four-year degree in the past, but now they do.
The employers are expecting a more educated and trained workforce.
Compared to a traditional college education, a community college BA can be a steal. In California, tuition will be $10,560 total. It's got to make traditional four-year schools nervous, right? California State Senator Marty Block says nope.
We're not duplicating anything that the UCs or Cal State offer.
The schools facing real competition, he says, will be for-profit colleges who offer these specialized degrees at much higher prices. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
We have a map, by the way, of the states where community colleges do offer four-year programs and some information on the programs themselves at our website. It's marketplace.org. Foot Locker reported second quarter profits today. They jumped 39%, jumped being the operative phrase, because that number has a whole lot to do with basketball shoes and Nike. Kate Davidson reports.
Foot Locker's net income for the quarter was $92 million. Analyst Sam Poser with Stern Agee & Leach says the company is doing a lot of things right. Plus,
athletic shoes are on fire, basketball shoes specifically.
And Nike, he says, controls 95% of the basketball shoe biz. The buzz largely surrounds its marquee names.
Air Jordan shoes, Kobe, LeBron, Kevin Durant.
And the buzz persists, says Morningstar analyst Paul Swinand, because athletic companies, and especially Nike,
they do a fantastic job of limiting who gets what colors, what sizes, and how many pairs.
He says Foot Locker is a valuable partner to Nike, so it gets the most popular styles in moderation.
That ensures that supply is not quite meeting demand, and it means that if the shoes are popular, they're going to be a little bit rare.
Swinand says the two companies need each other, but Foot Locker might need Nike a little bit more. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Big data, the science and to some degree the art of collecting huge amounts of information and making sense of it, was for a long time the domain of corporate America for the simple reason that they had most of the data about what we buy, what we spend, and what ads we respond to. But the art and the science is evolving. As we saw in 2008 and 2012 especially, big data has become a major part of modern political campaigns. From politics and campaigns eventually come policies. So now governments and nonprofits are starting to see data as a way to tackle social problems. Marketplace's David Gura has that story.
After a decade digging through corporate data, Raed Ghani wanted to do something different.
So I decided one day just to arbitrarily pick a date to quit.
Ghani gave himself 3 months to find a job, a position with the potential for what he calls social impact. A few weeks later, Ghani became the chief scientist on President Obama's reelection campaign.
It was a fairly random detour.
He and his team did pioneering work on fundraising and analytics. For now, Ghani is done with politics, but he says that detour was eye-opening. It showed him there are other applications for data science. Today, Ghani teaches at the University of Chicago, where he runs something called the Data Science for Social Good Summer Fellowship.
The reason I started the program was really looking back at myself, saying I would have loved to be in a program like that.
48 of the world's brightest data scientists, students from more than 30 universities, have spent 12 weeks in Chicago. They've worked with community organizations, NGOs, city governments to tackle social problems like maternal mortality and homelessness.
They have no idea that those problems have data and that their skills can be helpful in solving those problems.
They set up shop in an unfinished office space in downtown Chicago, where they've been programming in Python and R. Those are the hammer and hacksaw in a data scientist's toolbox. The fellows have made themselves at home here. In the kitchen, behind a stack of boxes, there's coffee and what's left of a pie. And tucked in a corner, there's a ping pong table. The outside groups, the Sunlight Foundation, Wiki Energy, Chicago Public Schools, to name a few, they gave the fellows two things, problems to tackle and data, lots and lots of data.
Hey everyone, we're gonna get started, so if you want to take seats.
This week, the fellows gathered at 1871, that's a tech incubator high above the Chicago River, to show off what they accomplished. One group devised a new way for the World Bank to look for corporate collusion in development projects. Right now, the bank has to rely on whistleblowers.
The World Bank can be more proactive in its activities, and so it can say, the forecast is that this contract likely isn't so good, and then they can go investigate it.
Another group found a way for the Chicago Department of Public Health to pinpoint homes where children are at the highest risk of lead poisoning. Right now, the department has a list of tens of thousands of housing units where kids could be at risk. The fellows narrowed that down considerably. Their model suggests the department could focus on 378 units where the risk is highest. That would take just 2 months, and it would cost less than $200,000.
Compare that with $100 million in almost 80 years. We're calling this a data science success story.
After the presentations, the data scientists fielded questions science fair style. Sam Zhang worked on ways to improve outreach to Americans who don't have health insurance. He says he and his fellow data scientists had a lot to learn about the organizations they partnered with.
I came in, I didn't know what like Medicare, Medicaid, what the healthcare subsidies were like. And the first few weeks were just like print out a bunch of papers about it and just read.
And those organizations, he says, had a lot to learn about data, what it can do, what someone trained in analytics or econometrics can do with it. Zhang went to Swarthmore College. He acknowledges he could have wound up in Silicon Valley.
The thing is that Raed's trying to steal us away from the people optimizing ad clicks. And I think he's pretty successful.
Some fellows will return to PhD programs. A handful will remain in Chicago, where they'll continue to work on these projects. Raed Ghani's hope is they'll all leave with a new sense of what data can do. In Chicago, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Coming up,
if you remove the need to earn a paycheck, then you remove a little bit of what do other people like requirement, and the what do I think is awesome part can take over.
Yeah, it's a pretty big if, though, huh? But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here we go. The Dow Industrials gave up 38 points, 0.2%, closed at 17,001. The NASDAQ gained 6 points, 10%, 45.38. The S&P 500 slipped 0.3%. Finished at 1988. For the week, the Dow up 2%. The NASDAQ added 1.6%. S&P 500 up 0.7%. Janet Yellen of the Federal Reserve says labor in the United States is underutilized. That is partly because a lot of people who want full-time jobs can only find temporary or part-time jobs. And so you get this. Good times for Manpower Group, up 120% in the last 2 years, off 0.2%. Today, True Blue, which supplies blue-collar temps, up 100% the past 2 years, up 0.5%. Today, and you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. On this day in 1920, women are given the right to vote as the 19th Amendment was added to the Constitution. In 1939, Major League Baseball airs its first televised game between the Brooklyn Dodgers and the Cincinnati Reds. And it's time to leave all of your troubles and grudges behind, because it's National Kiss and Makeup Day. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and the word of the day today is feed, as in news feed, or Facebook feed, or Twitter feed, that theoretically personalized flow of social media information on your network of choice. A funny thing happened on the way to my Twitter feed this week. I started noticing posts from people I don't follow. It wasn't a glitch or a bug. It was, it turns out, Twitter deciding for itself what it wanted me to see. Kurt Wagner covers social media for Recode. Kurt, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, hey, thanks for having me.
First steps first, I suppose. What exactly is it that Twitter is doing here?
Well, what Twitter's doing is they're taking popular tweets and they're inserting them into user feeds. And a lot of these tweets are showing up from people that they're not following. So, for example, I may not follow CNN, but I may start seeing tweets from CNN in my feed because people that I do follow like CNN, and they're engaging with those tweets.
Okay, but I don't want to see tweets from CNN in my feed. I mean, what's the Twitter rationale here?
Yeah, that's the issue. That's the problem that Twitter's going to have to face, is that they're trying to encourage people to discover new content. Some people, that's going to rub them the wrong way. They're not going to care what their friends like. They follow people because that's who they want to hear from. But as Twitter tries to grow its user base and encourage people to continue to engage with the service, they need to show them what's out there that they haven't yet discovered.
And a translation of grow the user base would be, in the long run, to somehow make them more money.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the more users they have, the more that they can go to advertisers and say, hey, our user base is bigger. We know more information about the people who are using the service. And, of course, the more engaged you are, the more signals that you're giving them, hey, I'm favoriting this tweet, I'm retweeting this tweet. That kind of shows what you're interested in, and that enables them to, you know, target you more efficiently right. with ads.
Right. This is, when I saw the story yesterday, the first thing I thought of was Facebook, right? Because this is a little bit the Facebookization of Twitter, because Facebook does the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. Throw stuff in your feed that you don't necessarily want to see.
Yeah, absolutely. So Facebook is, you know, long been known for their newsfeed algorithm, and essentially they're tinkering with it all the time. They're trying to figure out, okay, so you may have 1,000 friends on Facebook. Obviously, you don't want to see posts and updates from 1,000 people every day. So they're trying to figure out which people matter the most to you and show you that content. And this is kind of the first time that Twitter's been doing something similar. They, you know, this is an algorithm that they're using as well.
Yeah, the risk, of course, is that people are going to either just speed scroll through their feed and go straight to the top and blow past all these other things because they're from people they don't recognize, or just stop being on there at all. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the great things about Twitter all this time is that you've really been able to personalize what you see, right? I mean, you're only seeing tweets from people you choose to follow. If you don't care to hear what Kurt Wagner has to say, you don't have to follow me on Twitter, and that's totally fine.
Right.
But
course,
what this
now,
is doing
now, I have to go follow you.
Right. Hear what I have to say. And so I think that's going to rub some people the wrong way, of course, is because, you know, they feel like they're losing control over what they see.
You can, should you so choose, follow Kurt Wagner on Twitter, at KurtWagner8. He covers social media for Recode. Kurt, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Kai. I appreciate it.
The Emmys are coming up, not as they have been for nearly 40 years, on a Sunday night, but this coming Monday. The show rotates from network to network, and this year NBC is the lucky winner. The Emmys are, of course, a big deal in broadcasting, and Sundays are the most watched night of the week. So why is NBC putting the industry's big show on a Monday? Well, it turns out it's all about economics, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith explains.
Last year, CBS scored a touchdown with the Emmys. It aired the award show right after a football game, and the NFL audience mostly stuck around for the awards. The Emmys saw its biggest audience in years. NBC airs Sunday Night Football, so why aren't they doing the same?
Sunday has become the biggest night of television.
Media analyst Jack Myers says NBC doesn't want to compete with people's favorite shows, or another award show airing Sunday night.
The MTV Video Music Awards are that night, and last year we had the twerking with Miley Cyrus. There's a lot of interest this year in the program, and it's that 18 to 34 audience.
So NBC is rolling the weekday dice. Rick Ducey is with media research firm BIA Kelsey.
It's actually pretty interesting to see this kind of experimentation happening. There's a lot of economics at stake here.
Advertisers often pay 50% more for ads around live events like the Emmys. Ducey says if NBC pulls off a Monday night Emmys, we'll likely see more special event TV creeping out over the week. But that's a big if, says media expert Toby Miller.
The difficulty is, of course, corralling everybody in the way you can on a Sunday for something like the Oscars or the Super Bowl, where they'll give up 7 or 8 hours quite happily.
Miller says those leisure hours are key for the tweeting and Facebook posts people like to do around award shows and the ad possibilities that come with that. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The internet startup version of the American dream is to change the world. See also Twitter, Google, Facebook, et al. And if you happen to make a boatload of money along the way, well, so be it. But when all you get is that boatload of money, what do you do next? From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Stan Alcorn has the story of the rise and subsequent left turn of an unusual entrepreneur.
In 2011, Charles Forman looked like he was living his childhood dream. With just a high school education, he'd built a growing video game company called OMG Pop. And yet...
I remember at that time I was, like, soliciting opinions on how to be happier in life.
Video games are an industry based on hits. And after 6 years and more than $15 million of venture capital, OMG Pop was still hitless. Forman had gone from idealistic game maker to overworked manager with a constant ringing in his ears.
I was just burnt out.
He quit. And by the next spring, he had just $1,700 in his bank account. That's when he got a call from Dan Porter, OMG Pop's then CEO.
Dan calls me up and he's like, Charles, you're going to be so rich that you could wallpaper your new three-bedroom apartment with iPads. iPad 3s.
Here's Porter.
It is possible that I was trying to get him excited. He didn't know all of this kind of craziness that was going on behind the scenes.
The source of the craziness was a new OMG Pop game called Draw Something, a kind of smartphone Pictionary. It had topped the iTunes charts for 6 weeks straight and made OMG Pop the hottest property in the gaming world. A property which Forman still owned a big piece of, even after he quit.
Reed signs a little bit of breaking news about an acquisition of OMG Pop.
San Francisco-based Zynga reportedly paid about $200
million. $180 million for OMG Pop. Make some sense of that for me.
Overnight, Forman became a multimillionaire.
It sounds so stupid, but at the time, I'm like, do I have to buy a car now? Like, seriously, do I have to fly business class? Is that a thing people do?
He didn't buy a Rolls Royce. In fact, he doesn't drive. He didn't even move out of his apartment. The fifth-floor walk-up in downtown Manhattan. It feels like a tech startup version of a college dorm room. The walls are bare, and on the floor there's a broken TV and stacks of plastic boxes full of DIY electronics.
He's like crazy artist programmer guy?
Dan Albritton was the other founder of what became OMG Pop. He says Forman has two qualities that he shares with other good product designers.
They have a really good sense of what other people like. And then they also have a complete disregard for what other people like and just what they think is awesome.
Albritton says it's that tension that makes interesting products. But Forman's millions might change the equation.
If you remove the need to earn a paycheck, then you remove a little bit of what do other people like requirement, and the what do I think is awesome part can take over.
These days, what Forman thinks is awesome is making a movie.
What is the origin story of, like, the Steve Jobs of robotics look like? That's kind of the theme.
He wrote a screenplay, but to revise it, he spent day and night programming software to turn it into a storyboard.
I could draw, you know, a face.
This is how he hopes to disrupt Hollywood.
Paint it in.
Shareable cartoon versions of scripts, which he thinks will make the screenwriting process more collaborative and iterative. More like making a video game.
I'd imagine, like, anyone from the outside looking in would be like, that's cute, but you don't know how this really works. That's probably right.
For Forman, this is what millions of dollars buy. Not retirement or world travel, but a couple years of making software for an industry he's just starting to understand. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, it is a testament to A, August, B, Fridays, and C, computerized trading. According to CNBC, this was the lightest trading day of the year so far on the New York Stock Exchange. Just 2.25 billion shares changed hands. Just 2.25 billion. All right, we're out of here. Today, the Dow off 38 points, about 0.2%. The NASDAQ gained 6 points. That's a 0.1%. The S&P 500 off 3 points, 0.2% on that particular index. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yore. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you on Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.